Welcome to Real World Rewind, a monthly podcast where we take a look back at some of our favorite movies from years gone by, reminding ourselves that entertainment is not mindless. Before we dive into this month's film, I am very excited to announce a major change coming to Real World Rewind. So from this point forward on the show, I will be joined by a co-host, so it won't just be me leading you aimlessly around all of these different films. And the co-host that will be joining us is none other than my wife, Shannon Grimes.
Hey, everybody.
Now, this doesn't mean that we're done having guests on the show. We will still continue to do that from time to time to keep things lively and interesting.
Are you saying that I'm not lively and interesting?
Exactly. The boring couple. No. But it is just Shannon and I this month, and I am ready to get started on this new leg of the journey. Shannon, you are as well?
I am. I truly am. Even though I'm apparently too boring for everyone. I'll try to step up my game a little.
Well, this month on Real World Rewind, in celebration of the most recent installment of Legendary's Monsterverse with Kong Skull Island, we're going to be taking a look back at the 2014 Godzilla film, which is the first entry in the Monsterverse, or what Legendary is calling Monsterverse now. Godzilla was directed by Gareth Edwards, who is more recently of Rogue One fame, and it stars Bryan Cranston, very briefly, and Aaron Taylor Johnson, Elizabeth Olsen, and Ken Watanabe. And it's scored beautifully by Alexandra Desplat. Now, this was a film that divided both critics and fans alike, and we'll talk about that in a bit, sharing our own thoughts on some of the criticisms the film has received. But first, let's kick off our discussion by sharing our expectations, or a little bit about our expectations that we had going into this film during its theatrical run, because we both did get to see this during its theatrical run. So, Shannon, why don't you go first and share some of your expectations?
Well, I will say, going into the movie, I really didn't expect much. My only childhood experiences with Godzilla was when I was little. Like, I knew the name, and I knew that there was a giant lizard that terrorized cities. But I perceived that I was not allowed to say his name, else I was using the Lord's name in vain. So I called him Goshzilla. And then when I was 15, I went to a birthday party where we critiqued the old films, that the monster kaiju films with like the ant thing and the big enormous lady, and we watched some of Godzilla, probably the American one, the old one. And so I never really watched the movies. I never really watched those movies, like, for the sake of actually seeing them and enjoying them. Like, the only time I saw them, it was to make fun of them. So, I really didn't expect much when I was going into the movie, and honestly, I probably would not have seen it if we hadn't just gotten married. But I was pleasantly surprised. Like, it kind of changed my mind, my opinion about the possibilities of this whole monster movie thing being, like, fun. Because I didn't realize that it could, there was actually potential there. But I think probably what captured me about it was the music. Because I have always been a music geek, and that drew me in because it was such a powerful score that really, really affects the way that you see these different scenes, with the swell and the rise and the fall of the music and in certain places, and the really kind of, I'm trying to think of the word of it, like sneaky music, I guess, at the very beginning is really, really schnazzy. And it was just, I mean, it's just a good movie. I enjoy it.
And he shall henceforth be known as Goshzilla.
Yes.
You heard it here first. they should totally change his name to Goshzilla.
Goodnesszilla.
Goodnesszilla. Well, so I had a very different experience because I did grow up a fan of Godzilla and kaiju films more broadly. I ate them up. I was not trying to be a bad pun there either. but I was a huge kaiju head growing up. And Godzilla has always been my favorite.
Did you just say kaiju head?
Yeah, kaiju head.
Just, like, imagine this monster with a human body and, like, a dinosaur head. Like, it looks like something from Toy Story or something.
That's coming up. I mean, this is, you know, the same company who's running the DC universe, so who knows what kind of crazy things we may see. But, yeah, I was really excited when Godzilla was first announced and when we got a little bit of a tease at Comic-Con in 2013, I think it was. I'd been out of my mind excited for this film. And I was also really excited to see what Gareth Edwards would do with a movie like this. And at that time, I mean, now Gareth Edwards is a big deal because he's directed this and he's directed a little franchise called Star Wars, like I said. But at that point, he was relatively unknown. He had directed a little indie monster movie called Monsters. We had watched
it. I'm sure
that.
You've told me that, but I forgot.
Yeah, and I had seen Monsters and really appreciated what he did with that, especially working, you know, in the indie scene with a much more limited budget. I really was digging his visual style and his grounded perspective, which we'll talk about more later on. And so I was excited to see what he would do with it. And I was very pleased with the film overall and still am. And I appreciate especially how this Godzilla film is very much in the tradition of the kaiju films, especially of the early 50s before we got into the 60s. And I'll talk more about that later, I think, as well. Like Shannon mentioned, I think Desplat's score is awesome. It's very, very eerie in many places.
That's the word I was looking for. Thank you.
There's one of my favorite moments in terms of score is when Godzilla first confronts the mother kaiju while she's at her nest in like Chinatown, I guess it is. And there's all those Chinese lanterns hanging up and it's smoky and everything.
Oh yeah.
And there's that like really discordant piano note or notes that keeps repeating. That's super creepy, super eerie. And then he lets out his roar in the fullest way we've seen it up to that point in the movie. And so I love how Desplat's score just evokes this really dramatic sense of suspense and dread, even of these monsters approaching. So I love the score, and unfortunately we probably won't get to talk about that enough in this film. But
just know it's good, y'all.
Yeah, it is. It is very good, and it's worth listening to on its own.
Spotify.
Yeah, exactly. So we're both fans, I guess, right? We're both fans of this movie.
Yeah, I do like this.
Coming at it from different perspectives. Me as someone who, you know, came into it wanting to like it very much and wanting it desperately to be good. And you...
I was just kind of there.
Yeah, you were just there.
But I liked it.
We do have a really fun memory. I mean, because of the way Edward shoots his films, again, in a grounded perspective... I think his films play especially well on big screens, like IMAX screens. And we did get a chance, the second time I saw this in theaters, the first time you saw it, we went to an IMAX screen in town. And we went to an early morning showing, and we were the only ones in this massive, massive IMAX theater. And so,
it's like a 400-seat theater.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun, and I will always have that memory. And seeing that film and hearing that film on the big screen was something that I don't think I will soon forget. So, both fans, and we're approaching it from that perspective. That being said, let's talk a little bit about some of the criticisms that this film received. Because, like I mentioned in the intro, it did divide critics and fans pretty widely, I think. And one of the most prominent, or the most prominent criticism of this movie that I've encountered, at least, is that there's not enough Godzilla. Most people tend to really like Edward's vision, more or less, and really appreciate a lot of things about the movie, but if they're upset with something, it's that Godzilla wasn't on screen more. And I know a lot of people have timed it, and I can't remember if it's like 12 minutes or something like that he's on screen out of a 2-hour movie, or maybe it's 20 minutes. I don't know the exact figure, but he's not on there as much as some people wanted.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess we can go ahead and address some of those criticisms. Do you want me to jump in first, or do you have like things you want to?
Oh, go ahead.
Okay. Well, I can get us started. So the Godzilla and kaiju films of the early 1950s were a lot more restrained in their approach to showing the monster and revealing the monster, which is exactly what we get in this film. Because, like I said, this Edwards Godzilla is really seated more in the tradition of these very early kaiju films, like the 1954 Godzilla and even Rodan, where you really have a lot of suspense and tension and build up before you actually see the monster. It's seated much more firmly in that tradition than it is the levity that would come to characterize the genre later on, where you did some really like fun and then like just some really silly stuff. And I think both of those traditions are great for their own reasons, but I think in some sense, criticizing this movie on the grounds that the monster doesn't show up enough doesn't really appreciate what this film is trying to do. It's not trying to be a Pacific Rim type movie where you've got all of this, like, you know, hours of cool action or things like that. It really is a callback to those early films of the 1950s that kicked off the entire kaiju craze. So I think even just accepting the film on its own terms and accepting it for what it wants to be, there should be at least some room for appreciation of Godzilla being shown in a more restrained approach. And this is just my personal opinion, but I think that Edwards' restrained approach makes those moments where we actually do see Godzilla much more impactful and awe or terror inspiring than they would be if we just saw him from 30 minutes in the film and had him for another hour and a half. I think the moments when we do see Godzilla unleashed in this film are some of the most powerful depictions of a movie monster on screen ever. I would even go that far. I think the restraint does that. And I think we'll have a chance to talk about this a little bit later on when we talk about Kong Skull Island in brief. And I'm sure there will be a Kong Skull Island Real World Theology full episode that will dive into that much more deeply. So
check it out.
Yeah, we'll just be scratching the surface. But I do like this restrained approach. And I think it's especially a good approach to take and an insightful approach to take in the age of Michael Bay. For lack of a better term. In an age of Michael Bay, which Michael Bay is a filmmaker who says, you know, less is not more, more is more. In fact, more and more and more is more. A movie like this really stands out. I mean, one of the 1500 Transformer movies was released the year that Godzilla came out in 2014.
I think it was number four.
Yeah. And then there was also, Michael Bay didn't direct this first one, but it was the Ninja Turtles movie. Yeah, which I always spell T-U-R-D-L-E-S.
That's terrible.
The Ninja Turtles movie. In an age where you've got all this insane action, which fine, these films can and may be, I've not seen a Transformers movie in a long time, can and may be some degree of fun on their own. A movie that's actually willing to show restraint, I think, stands out from the crowd and gives it even a better chance of standing the test of time. So I really appreciate that about this film, is how restrained it is. And that being said, I still am able to appreciate some of the more fun monster movies as well. I mean, you can testify that I'm a huge fan of Pacific Rim.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I have tons of...
We have a 2 foot tall action figure of a Jaeger somewhere in this house.
And that's not even the only one. And I have the Pacific Rim comic books. I mean, I'm a huge fan of these kinds of fun movies, but, I do appreciate the approach that Edwards takes, and I appreciate the way he shoots the film. So any thoughts to add about this, Chrissy?
Yeah, I actually thought of a few things. So, I mean, I think the last time we just watched it a little bit ago for preparing for this, I think was only the third time I had seen it, because I saw it once in theaters, and then we saw it once when it came out on DVD or Blu-ray or whatever, and then we just watched it again. I think that's the third time I've seen it. And I think the first time I remember being kind of shocked that there wasn't more Godzilla in it, because my only my only knowledge of Godzilla was like the old movie, which I guess probably was the 60s one, the Americanized version.
Mm-hmm.
And
like 50s, 59. The original came out in 54.
Good to know. and so, you know, kind of seeing Godzilla as like a plastic dinosaur destroying, you know, like toothpick houses and stuff. A little bit like silly. I didn't really anticipate this being such a dramatic film and having so much emphasis on the actual effect of these monsters on the world. And like, okay, first of all, I promise that this is not in any way a realistic film. But this film, I guess because of the way that it shows you the effect of the monsters before it shows you how cool the monsters are, it kind of like grounds the audience in quote-unquote reality before it amps up the fun and like the cool action sequences and stuff, which is an interesting way to present it, because then everyone's not just so, you know, so focused on how big Godzilla is and how much damage there is or how much, you know, stuff he can throw around and stuff. Like, they actually are able to see what happens to these characters and the sadness that can come from what they do and how they live. And it almost reminded me a little bit of the difference between like Marvel movies and DC movies, because DC movies tend to be more solemn and focus on the damage of something that powerful, whereas Marvel movies tend to be like, oh yeah, it's okay that we destroyed New York, like no problem. Which I like both of them. I'm a superhero fan and I like both of those things, and I don't really have a problem with either way. But it was interesting to focus for me to see in Godzilla that they were focusing so much on the effect of the Mutos,
yeah,
the monsters on people before they just showed them fighting and doing mm-hmm. things together.
Yeah. And that's a really good point. And I think, again, I think sometimes the idea that the movie just didn't succeed gets put out there when I really don't think that's the case. I think this movie is doing exactly what it set out to do: be more somber, focused, you know, grounded in a human perspective.
There you go.
And
it's not reality, it's human perspective.
And I think it's accomplished that. Now, it's an entirely different question, and a question of taste to a certain extent, of whether or not you prefer that, right? I mean, it's okay not to like this movie, but I think it's a much harder argument to make that this movie doesn't succeed in what it sets out to accomplish. I think it's very successful there. But that's my two cents on it. Another criticism, so we talked about that, and we could talk about that more, and probably we'll get around to it in a circular way in a bit. But another criticism is that there's not enough Bryan Cranston. And I would just say, amen, there's not enough Bryan Cranston.
Why did he have to die? He didn't have to die. He didn't really have to die.
So I do think there's not enough Bryan Cranston. And one of the reasons I think his presence is particularly missed is because he's a much better actor than Aaron Taylor Johnson. And once Aaron Taylor Johnson's left by himself, like, he's okay. But really, if he's not, like, saving a kid or he doesn't have a really good reason to be on screen, he's just not that interesting to...
If he's not being a soldier.
Yeah,
his soldieriness was cool.
He's not that interesting of a character to watch. And the scenes where Bryan Cranston's interacting with him are so much have so much more oomph behind them. That's the technical term, yeah. I think, is oomph. But I heartily agree with that. I think that's enough, though, probably for right now of, I don't know, dealing or talking about our thoughts on criticisms of this film.
Even though one of them wasn't a criticism, because we just turned it on people.
But I think we can also take some time, and should take some time, to talk about this Godzilla film as a big environmental metaphor. And I think this is something we see in the second entry in the MonsterVerse as well. But the original Godzilla and other kaiju films, but especially Godzilla, worked as a metaphor for nuclear power and fears of nuclear power. I mean, Godzilla was released in Japan, I mean, a Japanese film released in 1954, less than 10 years after the bomb was dropped.
And I mean, who would be more scared of nuclear weapons, honestly, than the Japanese? Like, they'd have the most reason, like, their culture at that time had the most reason to be scared of nuclear fear, of nuclear weapons in the world.
Right, and so you see these fears manifested in the form of a monster. That also allows them to speak to a broader international audience, because especially in America, Japanese films were pretty heavily censored in America after World War II. And so having your nuclear fears manifested in the form of a monster, it makes it a little bit more palatable to international sensibilities, because we all love monsters stomping on toothpick cities, or guys in big suits stomping on
or toys.
But I think it's really interesting that this Godzilla movie, appropriately, I think, changes that mythos a little bit. So instead of Godzilla in this movie being a creation, a product of nuclear testing, or, you know...
Is that what the original was?
Mm-hmm.
I don't really remember much about the original.
So instead of him being a nuclear product, and he's even a nuclear product in that, more fun than it should be, a 1998 Godzilla film, and I'm just totally losing the director.
I'll look it up.
Right now. But,
keep talking.
But so they changed this mythos where he's not a nuclear product, but instead those nuclear tests were intended to kill Godzilla. So I guess in some sense he is still a product of, you know, of our nuclear efforts. And it certainly has, the movie still has a nuclear subtext built into it. But this Godzilla builds on that original mythos by taking a more environmental approach to the Godzilla character. Oh, Shannon just showed me that Roland Emmerich directed the 98 Godzilla. Independence Day, the original Independence Day.
Oh.
The one that's worth watching. That's a whole nother story. But yeah, so Edwards builds upon this mythos by taking an environmental angle. And Edwards made a statement in one of the interviews that he did that I think is really worth digging into and pushes us towards some of the lines we get in the film. Edwards says, Godzilla is about this idea that these monsters come back to punish us for the way we've treated the world. These monsters have come back to punish us for the way we've treated the world. And then there's a line I'm going to let you point it out that you said we should talk about it in relation to this.
Oh, yeah. Well, I was kind of taking this in a different direction, but...
we can come full circle.
Okay. The other line was when one of the characters...
Shirazawa. Ken Watanabe's character.
That one. When that guy said, "The arrogance of man is thinking nature is in our control and not the other way around." Oh, it's written right here. Sarazawa said that. Yeah. that was an interesting quote, but I will get around to saying why that one hit home with me, because it's a little different than the environmental angle.
Okay. Well, let's do both of these. So I think just on those two levels, the Edwards quote and then what we see in the film that Sarazawa says, and many other things, this movie really does speak to our duty, I think especially as Christians, to care for and tend to the world that God has created. And for some reason, when you start talking about environmental things in Christian circles... At least in more conservative Christian circles, which actually we both run in, people tend to get uptight.
Fancy.
And I think part of that is because of the ways that climate change has been politicized or even presented. And this comes, like, it's been politicized by people on the left, and it's been politicized and transformed into, like, these strange rhetorical arguments by people on the right as well. So it's both sides, you know. It takes two to tango. But because of the political connotations of climate change or environmental ethics or whatever you want to call them, people get uptight about this. But, I mean, God initially, in the book of Genesis, created Adam and Eve and put them in the garden to tend and keep it. And he told them that they were supposed to have dominion over the entire earth. At times, I think that word dominion has been misused to make it almost a sense of we have this domineering degree of control over everything, where really we can do with it what we please. But when we see the way Adam and Eve cared for the garden, they tended it and they kept it. They didn't destroy the garden, right? I mean, even when they were harvesting things or doing whatever, it was to tend and keep it and to promote the flourishing of life. And so the idea of having dominion over the earth isn't just about us being able to do whatever we will. It's also about promoting flourishing and life, you know.
Right.
All over the earth, if that doesn't sound too touchy-feely. And there's been tons and tons of books written about this, and we don't have time to go into all of that in great detail. But I do think that this movie is – it can serve as an important reminder that that the way we treat the earth – is important. And again, I don't want to wrap that up in certain, like, you have to support this certain political cause or that political cause, but
if there's a recycling bin nearby, you know, throw your plastic bottle in there. I saw something interesting about how, this total side note, plastic bottles are being used to create clothing in third world countries. So, and it was really fascinating. It was a How It's Made video. You can look it up on YouTube. But it's like there's so many things that we can do instead of, you know, throwing things out and adding things to landfill. Mm-hmm. Landfills, which, you know, it's I think it's important to watch after what you do. Lead an example for your children. Show them that the earth is important and grow some things and spend time in nature and be amazed by it and you know, appreciate that God has given us such really a magical thing as plants and animals that we can look to and, you know, have for food and shelter and beauty because...
Smelling.
Yes. Well, some smelling, some allergies, but... But there's a lot out there to appreciate, and we should be careful not to take it for granted.
Yeah, and it makes perfect sense that this movie would address those issues since climate change is, you know, rapidly becoming one of the most pressing issues, you know, facing our planet and our world today. Mm-hmm. And I guess I may be alienating some listeners by saying that, but I do think it's at least a pressing issue. Even if you want to say that it's a myth or whatever, that it is a pressing issue because a lot of people are talking about it. So I think that this film would speak to those concerns, in addition to some of the nuclear subtext, is really insightful. And it'll be interesting to see where that continues to go as the monster verse continues. But I'm really curious to, hear what you were thinking about in terms of this quote.
Oh, okay. The interesting thing to me is when he was saying that, you know, nature is not in our control. And that got me to thinking that humans in general, all of us, really tend to think that we can bite off more than we can chew and be just fine. And it was an interesting reminder to me in that moment that I tend to look at really anything, whatever the situation is, and be like, okay, I can handle that. And, like, forget that I can't do anything without God. And so it's not just a matter of preparation, although being prepared is good. But, you know, sometimes no matter what you do, things are going to happen. Like, they made all these, in the movie, they made all these plans with the bomb, and they were going to lure him out in the ocean. And then the he, Spider-Bat, stole the bomb. That's what I'm calling them, Spider-Bats. You know, he stole the bomb, and then it ended up in the middle of San Francisco. Is that where it was?
Yep.
And that was something they couldn't have prepared for. And so, you know, that's something that was out of their control, even though Madden thought it was in their control. And it was just an interesting reminder to me to be constantly, like, surrendering myself to God because he is in control and I am not.
Yeah. I think these monster movies have a good way of getting to the heart of that. As general, again, from a non-Christian perspective, but they give us a sense that we're in a much larger world or a much larger universe where we're not the center of it, or where, you know, we're not even the, you know, alpha predators, so to speak. I think these monster movies, movies get at this in a really interesting way, and we'll obviously now get to see that more and more in future films. So that was a really good direction you took that.
Thanks.
You pointed that out. And now Gene's going to tell us we're just flirting too much again. But, so we've talked a little bit about this environmental metaphor, and we could talk about that more and talk about more about how this film speaks on a theological level. But I also want to take just a second to talk about a more recent film, which we don't normally do on Rewind.
But we're taking the road less traveled.
We are. Since Kong Skull Island has just come out, and since we've seen it, I think this presents a really good opportunity to let these movies dialogue with one another and talk about how maybe the larger monsterverse is shaping up. As we kind of mentioned in our first segment of the show, Godzilla and Kong Skull Island are very, very different films, intentionally so. And as much as Godzilla is trying to be a more tonally serious film grounded in a human perspective, Kong Skull Island is, again,
not
more in the tradition of some of the 60s kaiju films that we saw, where we're doing some fun things. Those are very different films. And I'm not gonna try to argue that one is good and one is bad in and of its own right. They're very different animals. Godzilla is so much more restrained and serious, and Kong is more fun and action-packed. And I think ultimately that difference is a good thing, because I think it shows that there is going to be possibly a little bit of room for diversity in the monsterverse, where you can have both kinds of films exist. And I do enjoy both kinds of films. Like I said, I enjoy things like Pacific Rim. I enjoy a lot of the silly kaiju films of the 60s. But just with my natural disposition, I tend to gravitate more towards the tone of what we see in Edwards' Godzilla. That just tends to be my natural bent.
He's such a sad person.
It's also that I'm a Godzilla fan more than I am any other kaiju fan. So I like Godzilla more than I do King Kong. And so I'm naturally going to give Godzilla the benefit of the doubt. But I do like that tone a little bit more as well. And I think there's something that gets lost a little bit in Kong Skull Island without Gareth Edwards' sense of scale. And again, this is just my personal opinion. But I enjoyed Kong Skull Island. I really did. I don't like it as much as Godzilla, because that's just my natural bent. One of the things that Edwards does so well is he shoots almost everything from a human perspective. He said in multiple interviews for multiple films that he's been working on that he doesn't like to put a camera anywhere you couldn't realistically get a camera to go in real life. Yeah. So it's either going to be from a helicopter, you know, a helicopter looking down at something, or it's going to be inside of a skyscraper, or it's going to be from a person on the ground. And he does that in Godzilla. And I think because of that, he creates an incredible sense of scale and size, which is what he's known for in his films. He did that really well in Rogue One as well. But, I mean, there are a couple of awesome scenes where, for instance, the airport scene where the Muto comes in to the airport and sends off that chain reaction of airplanes being blown up.
Oh, yeah.
And instead of just getting that from some sort of aerial perspective, we get a shot inside the airport looking through the glass with other people all standing around.
Yeah.
And then we see Godzilla's huge foot just stomp down. Mm-hmm. And then we go outside and we get this pan up and we see Godzilla.
Yeah.
And so you, by shooting things from a human perspective, Godzilla, Godzilla's a good cameraman. Gareth Edwards really gives us a sense of how big these creatures are.
Yeah.
It really is awe-inspiring, seeing these creatures from a human perspective. And I felt like in Kong Skull Island, you lose that perspective quite a bit. And I think a lot of it is due to the setting as well. I mean, you're not in a city setting. So
not where there are like easily identifiable benchmarks.
Right. So some of that is due to the setting. But a lot of it is just due to the style of this director and Larry Fong, the cinematographer who I actually really like. There were a few point of view. Larry Fong is...
Which movie did he...
Sorry, Larry Fong was the cinematographer for Kong Skull Island.
Oh.
And he's a Zack Snyder collaborator, so...
did Zack Snyder direct Kong Skull Island?
He didn't. He directed Batman vs. Superman.
Okay, yes.
So, like, all this stylized action, like, that's where you see that
kind Sorry, of thing. Y'all, I'm not... I'm not super up to date on my directors. It's a work in progress.
That's no biggie. You miss some of that without Edward's sense of you know, grounded perspective, I think. Or at least I miss that a little bit. And so some of the action just wasn't as exciting to me in Kong Skull Island because I never really felt like I was invested in it in a way I was in Edward's film where I'm on the ground watching all of this stuff happen. But that is again, just my perspective. And I think they did try to incorporate a couple of first-person point of view shots in Skull Island, but they felt odd to me. There were a couple of shots where you look down the barrel of a gun, Call of Duty style. Just felt strange. Like it felt out of place to me. But again, that's my opinion. What do you think about all of this, or maybe even where the MonsterVerse is headed, or anything?
Ooh, I have so many things to choose from. Well, yeah, I guess I hadn't really thought about it until you just said it, but the way that Godzilla is shot always next to something that gives you an idea of its size, like there's one shot in there that I thought was funny because, you know, the military is trying to eradicate these creatures, but then Godzilla is just like swimming in the ocean and he's being lined by these ocean liners. Like he
the
has
battleships, yeah.
Yeah, the battleships all around him. And they're just kind of like floating on with him. But, you know, he's the length of like three of them or something. It is interesting to think about all the different shots from the skyscrapers. Like most of them take place like within a window or something. And that is really interesting because it does keep it more realistic. But I mean, I think I liked Kong a little bit more than you did.
Probably a little, yeah.
A little bit. I think the acting bothered me more than the other things. But I agree that it was harder to kind of identify how big things were because there were a few shots when Kong was like next to the he's next to the helicopters when he was throwing the helicopters everywhere. And then when he had, I don't know if I should say that because people may not have listened to it.
Yeah.
People may not have seen it. But like every once in a while they'll show him next to a human or like some part of him close to a human. And then you kind of understand how enormous King Kong is. But it was easy to forget in that movie because there were so many things happening. Yeah. Whereas in Godzilla, it's kind of like every single shot of him is up against something.
Proportionally, it's way more in Godzilla than it is in Kong Skull Island.
Yeah.
Like you said, there are shots of like him, you know, getting him stomping on somebody or something like that. And you're like, oh, wow, he's big. But they're just not nearly as many. And like you said, you tend to forget.
Yeah.
I think the best scene in Kong Skull Island, and this is not a spoiler because it's assuming you've seen any of the trailers, is when all of the choppers are flying in and it's against the, you know, the red sunset or sunrise, whatever it is. And he's silhouetted and you see these helicopters. That truly was a beautiful, beautiful moment. And really, Kong Skull Island is a I don't know. It's visually, I guess it's a more beautiful film. It's a more visually stunning film. Yeah. I really like Edward's camera work and compositions a lot better, but his color palette for this film, at least, was a lot more muted. A lot of grays. It's really dark. Whereas Kong Skull Island, again, especially being shot by Larry Fong, who shoots Snyder stuff, like, you know, it's like super colorful and explosion-y and reds and all of this stuff. And it is. It's very, very beautiful to look at. So I certainly appreciated that. I just really wanted a little bit more of that sense of scale that I got in Godzilla. But that's just my personal preference there. I am really excited about the direction that things seem to be going with the MonsterVerse overall. Like I said, I think there is going to be a lot of room for diversity. Can't wait to see Kong, to see Godzilla 2 and see him face off with maybe some of the things we get a hint of in Kong Skull Island. I think that's going to be...
Watch the post-trailer credit scene. Scene if you go see Kong.
Yep.
But you have to wait through the entire thing. There's like 10 minutes of credits.
Yep. Stay. You gotta stay for it all. It's a lot of fun. So I do enjoy both. Godzilla wins out for me and probably always will, just because of my personal preferences. But I'm really excited that we're going to get to see these kinds of monsters fighting on the big screen for years and years to come. I'm pretty giddy about that.
Until 2030.
I'm just sad that we're not going to get Godzilla 2 until 2019. So that seems...
No, it's like waiting for Star Wars Land.
We've gotten spoiled because of Marvel and DC and all of these other huge properties now. We're used to, and Star Wars, seeing a movie every single year.
We're so used to getting regular injections of our
And so we're like, what? We have to wait. But if Edward's Godzilla has taught us anything, it's that some things are certainly worth waiting for. And I'm sad that Edwards won't be directing the second Godzilla either. But I am still very much looking forward to it. Any other thoughts before we wrap up, or are we just about done here today?
I think that does it for me.
Okay. Well, that is going to wrap up this episode of Real World Rewind. Our very first episode with Shannon Grimes as a co-host.
Official.
With many more to come. So, Shannon, why don't you do the honors of taking us out this week?
Certainly. Thanks, everyone, for listening. We definitely want to hear what you think about Gareth Edwards' Godzilla. Do you love it? You totally agree with us? Or do you hate it and you think that we should redo this episode? And tell us what you think about Kong Skull Island if you've seen it. The easiest way to do both of those things is by joining the Real World Theology Discussion Group on Facebook. Also, if you've enjoyed the show, please take a second to subscribe to it on iTunes and leave us a rating or review. That wraps things up for us here. So until next month, thanks for rewinding with us. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This podcast has been a Real World Theology production. For more information, check out realworldtheology.com. And thanks for listening.
Now this is podcasting. Woo!
Do 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 do. Hey!